Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
All right. So we're going to talk today a little bit about what sort of that question of extremism, and first we're going to talk about the question of sort of pacing. So we acknowledged last week the way that the moderate clergy were wishing that Dr. King would sort of just slow the truck down a little bit, right? That he's in too much of a hurry and needs to just sort of let things play out. He gets really personal in response to that today, in a way that I think certainly is convicting for me. So the question here has been, you know, why not work along with there was a new administration coming in as the mayor and city council in Birmingham. They overlapped with the old mayor and city council because Birmingham was a wreck at the time as well. But the question of, you know, why not negotiate? He's going to address that first. So I'm going to take two paragraphs from page 2 of the letter. The big one at the bottom, and then before that, I'll do the second full paragraph. Dr. King writes, "You may well ask, why direct action? Why sit-ins, marches, and so forth? Isn't negotiation a better path? You are exactly right in your call for negotiation. Indeed, this is the purpose of direct action. Nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and establish such creative tension that a community that has consistently refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue. It seeks so to dramatize the issue that it can no longer be ignored. I just referred to the creation of tension as part of the work of the nonviolent resistor. This may sound rather shocking, but I must confess that I am not afraid of the word tension. I have earnestly worked and preached against violent tension, but there is a type of constructive nonviolent tension that is necessary for growth. Just as Socrates felt that it was necessary to create a tension in the mind so that individuals could rise from the bondage of myths and half-truths to the unfettered realm of creative analysis and objective appraisal, we must see the need of having nonviolent gadflies to create the kind of tension in society that will help men to rise from the dark depths of prejudice and racism to the majestic heights of understanding and brotherhood. So the purpose of direct action is to create a situation so crisis-packed that it will inevitably open the door to negotiation. We therefore concur with you in your call for negotiation. Too long has our beloved Southland been bogged down in the tragic attempt to live in monologue rather than dialogue." And then
so he stated that very well.
He did, yeah.
I mean, it's just incredible how well he stated that.
Right.
I'm not an expert on English, but any chance my second paper in college was read as an example of how not to write an essay.
Right,
but he did. He stated this very well. You know?
Yeah,
and I suppose it surprised the people how educated that was. I mean, how much.
I have a feeling that people
because blacks were not expected to have education and
right. Yeah, there's
know anything and be able to write something that well.
Right. I think that was a piece of how. On the one hand, that's a piece of how Dr. King gained the kinds of hearings that he gained, because he had you know, he had a doctorate in theology. He was not uneducated in any sense of the word. He speaks certainly throughout the letter and throughout his life. He draws on this huge depth and breadth of sort of scholarly theology. He cites Socrates here. He cites Aristotle and Aquinas in what we read last week, and he's doing this in jail, right? Mm-hmm. He's pulling all of these references essentially off the top of his head. Now he's got time to sort of go back through his memory palace and find where he's where he's stored these ideas, but he's got these like boom ready to hand and pulls them out as well in the spoken word, which is typically not written and scripted in the way that that this is. So yeah, this letter is on one foot, it is this scholarly work of philosophical theology, talking about here's, from a theological standpoint, here's how we justify what we're doing. And as Tom says, very eloquently, directly addressing the question of, well, why don't you negotiate? And framing the question of, how are we meant to negotiate, right? So he takes this call to negotiation and says, we absolutely want to negotiate, and the powers that we are up against refuse to negotiate unless we force them to the table, right? That's the use of nonviolent force here, is to compel the conversation to come to a place where the side that wants to just hold on to segregation has to come to the table, which means he's also got to bring the side that wants to just sort of let segregation play itself out because it'll fall apart eventually, right? That's sort of the position of the eight clergy, that this will fall apart. We agree with what you're trying to do, but we think you're in too much of a hurry to get there. And so he's got one leg of this letter is the philosophical, scholarly, theological ideas that sort of frame this in ways that are really hard to argue with. And on the other leg, this is a preacher. There are a couple of places in the letter where you can hear him sort of, he's doing this scholarly thing, and he's writing, and like Dr. King, I think, is more at home as a scholar when he's writing. His writing is more at home in that scholarly tone. His spoken word is very much at home in this personal preacherly style, right? In this really fiery, convicting preacherly style, he shifts, and so you can see him start to preach at several points in here. So he spends a little bit of time, sort of explaining why the new mayor, incoming mayor, Mr. Boutwell is going to do he's just as much a segregationist as Bull Connor was. He's just nicer about it. And then he turns. So all the way up through, there's the paragraph that begins one of the basic points in your statement. All the way up through the end of there, he quotes Niebuhr, Reinhold Niebuhr, in the final sentence. And then he turns. So here's this big paragraph at the bottom, most of which is all one sentence. Because he's preaching now. We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. Frankly, I have never yet engaged in a direct action movement that was, quote, well-timed, according to the timetable of those who have not suffered unduly from the disease of segregation. For years now, I have heard the word wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with a piercing familiarity. This wait has almost always meant never. It has been a tranquilizing thalidomide, relieving the emotional distress for a moment, only to give birth to an ill-formed infant of frustration. We must come to see with the distinguished jurist of yesterday that, quote, justice too long delayed is justice denied. We have waited for more than 340 years for our God-given and constitutional rights. The nations of Asia and Africa are moving with jet-like speed toward the goal of political independence, and we still creep at horse and buggy pace toward the gaining of a cup of coffee at a lunch counter. I guess it is easy for those who have never felt the stinging darts of segregation to say, wait. But when you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers at will and drown your sisters and brothers at whim, when you have seen hate-filled policemen curse, kick, brutalize, and even kill your black brothers and sisters with impunity, when you see the vast majority of your 20 million Negro brothers smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society, when you suddenly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering as you seek to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she cannot go to the public amusement park that has just been advertised on television and see tears welling up in her little eyes when she is told that Funtown is closed to colored children, and see the depressing clouds of inferiority begin to form in her little mental sky, and see her begin to distort her little personality by unconsciously developing a bitterness toward white people. Then, when you have to concoct an answer for a five-year-old son asking in agonizing pathos, Daddy, why do white people treat colored people so mean? When you take a cross-country drive and find it necessary to sleep night after night in the uncomfortable corners of your automobile because no motel will accept you. When you are humiliated day in and day out by nagging signs reading white and colored, when your first name becomes nigger and your middle name becomes boy, however old you are, and your last name becomes John, and when your wife and mother are never given the respected title Mrs., when you are harried by day and haunted by night by the fact that you are a Negro, living constantly at tiptoe stance, never knowing what to expect next, and plagued with inner fears and outer resentments, when you are forever fighting a degenerating sense of nobodiness, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait. There comes a time when the cup of endurance runs over, and men are no longer willing to be plunged into an abyss of injustice, where they experience the bleakness of corroding despair. I hope, sirs, you can understand our legitimate and unavoidable impatience. Yeah, you can hear him. Yeah. And that shift from the, you know, here's sort of why, how we're doing this is the right way for us to do this. And he spends a lot of time in the letter on that. When he shifts to this, you need to understand the experience of being a Negro in 1963. You need to understand what that experience is in order to understand why we are so impatient with this. He's grabbing the reader and dragging us into that impatience, right? Mm-hmm. And this is from the Christian Churches Together study guide, just sort of framing that a little bit more. Dr. King's litany of wrongs endured by African Americans makes clear not only the legalized inequities of segregation, but also its emotional and psychological impact. Segregation was the structural manifestation of an existential message. You are inferior. You are nobody. It is a mistake to think the civil rights movement was only about winning political and economic gains. At its heart, it was about creating a community that honors the full equality of all people. While we rightly celebrate desegregation, the Civil Rights Act, and other legal remedies, we must also acknowledge that a, quote, degenerating sense of nobodiness persists in the experience of many African Americans. Millions are still smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society. Millions are still cut off from hope for a future. Children growing up surrounded by substandard schools, housing, and neighborhoods still internalize a message of inferiority. The structures of our society must echo the truth that Dr. King called, quote, the birthright of every individual. I am a person with dignity and honor. So a question. In what way do the wounds of racism and segregation in the United States extend to all Americans? In what way do the wounds of segregation and racism in the United States extend to all Americans?
We still have separation, even though it's not by law or nobody tries to do it. I mean, mm-hmm. people live separately.
Yeah,
so to a big extent.
Yeah, so there is still this separateness, and at least as most of us think about it, it's not intentional on our part or anyone else's necessarily. Now there exist those who are clinging desperately to separateness in a very intentional and often violent way. Many who cling, still fairly intentionally, in ways that are less obviously violent. And then there are all the ways that we, as we go through our lives, sort of know where the boundary is between us and them. That we wouldn't want to carry racist attitudes. We wouldn't want to act in racist ways. And when we're honest, we know that we still do. So yeah, that's one of the places where we still carry that around.
Did you ask that question again?
Yeah. In what way do the wounds of racism and segregation in the United States extend to all Americans?
Well, I'll take a shot at that. I'm not sure all Americans is pretty inclusive, but I think I'll just speak for myself. That's what I should do. My dad was a different person in terms of his outlook, and as he aged, concerning blacks, he got more liberal or understanding, if you will. And in Marshalltown, there were very few black families where I first 16 years of my life. And Nevada had fewer. But I think fear of, I have good intentions, but fear of doing it around my other white friends, the repercussions of, mm-hmm. of I'm with the group, but now Warren's kind of going out doing something that his friends, not just be honest, my, maybe even friends and family, if you will, as the Amish, maybe I'd be shunned or maybe I would be treated differently. So then I pulled back. Mm-hmm. I had a tendency to maybe do something that I thought was an improvement in relations with students that I went to school with. But once again, hesitated. Now, fast forward, and some of you know this, my brother has three sons, and one of his sons married a black woman from Chicago area. I visited them in Cape Town when I was in Africa, so here he is, very Caucasian, raised in Morrison, Illinois. His wife is very dark, and the children are not real dark. They, you know, and his three daughters. And he's doing translating the Bible into African dialects. Mm-hmm. A nonprofit. I can't think of the name of it. It starts with a W. But anyway, when you throw that into your immediate family, mm-hmm. then it really, you know, all these preconceived thoughts that you had in here. I've got a nephew whose family is, you know, half black daughters.
Yeah.
And it's real easy then to get your comfort level. It went from being academic to boom.
Yeah.
Here in my immediate family.
Yeah.
And one of these things you say, and everybody else says it too, is that he's white and his wife is black and the kids are black.
Well, I didn't want to use the word mulatto. I thought that was an ancient term.
Yeah, that's not a word to use anymore.
Yeah. I don't know what. Okay, what? How should I describe it?
I'm not being critical.
I didn't know the right word.
It's interesting how we characterized our first black president as black, even though his mother was from Missouri, you know.
Right. Well, yeah. So the. So
it's very strange.
So Warren, thank you for noticing that there was a word that you were wanting to, not that you wanted to use the word, you didn't want to use the word, but you didn't know what other word to use.
Yes.
That's a place we often find ourselves.
Mixed race didn't sound right.
Yeah, so the more commonly used term now is biracial.
Thank you. Biracial.
And you know, acknowledging the ways in which the ways in which that identity is actually a lot more complicated than we ever imagined it was, right? Because back in the day, right, back in Dr. King's day, it was because there were laws and so forth, it was very clear who got to qualify as white and who had to not qualify as white, right? And the ways that the laws were set up, you know, the blood quotient laws, based on a certain amount of African-American ancestry, you would be officially qualified as black and not able to officially qualify as white. And you could not be both, right?
Have you read recently what that was?
I believe it was 116th. So if you had help with the math on that, 164th.
Yeah,
so it's if you had one great grandparent, does that work out to 164th? Somebody who does math?
Maybe more than that.
Yeah.
It may be more than that. Yeah. The irony is that the Nazis were more liberals than the people in Alabama.
Oh, say that one more time, Tom.
The Nazis were more liberal. They just had 1/4 made you Jewish.
Right.
A grandparent was Jewish.
So you had to be a lot more Jewish to be Jewish under Nazi Germany than black to be black under the Southern Jim Crow laws. I'm sorry. I'm going to take the word Southern out of that because that's part of the problem here. Under the Jim Crow laws. Under the 20th century American racial identity laws. So it didn't take very much to disqualify you from being white. And that's the thing, right? That's how you can tell that whiteness is the pure status there. If it doesn't take very much to make you something other than that, then that's where, you know, that's kind of where the idea of purity is. And now we've got terms like biracial, which is partly acknowledging that how we interact with race, and particularly how people of color interact with race, although I think we need to racialize whiteness a lot too, that white is also a race. For the purposes of this analysis. But the way that one interacts with the question of how race defines our going through the world, biracial folks are always navigating it as a question. people who are consistently raced by others as consistently white, consistently African American, consistently South Asian. I mean, there are all kinds of different sets of stereotypes and social categories that go with any of these racial distinctions, even now. If you're consistently raced, then you have one set of rules to work with. If you are inconsistently raced, which is often the case for biracial folks who, you know, skin tone is one thing, sort of the cultural setting you find yourself in is a different thing. All the different ways that we form that impression and categorize folks. Then you're always figuring out which rules you need to play by. And so sometimes you're white, sometimes you're black, sometimes, you know, for purposes of a given social interaction. We used to have the word passing. I mean, obviously the word still exists and y'all nodded your head, right? Once upon a time, there was a sort of a special ability that some folks of color had to pass for white. And when segregation especially was legally enforced or more strictly socially enforced, that was a useful place some folks could go. It was also a really dangerous place to go. Because if you were passing for white and got found out for being not white, that was worse, right? That was worse than just being black. It still happens. So when those cultural forces of racism show up in a traffic stop, or in a job interview, or in an interaction at a convenience store, the ways that that skin tone and other physical attributes, other cultural markers, dress and so forth, speech, the way that all of those markers get categorized, change the way that people experience the world, and particularly people of color. Part of what was so sort of gutting for me in this, the long sentence, the one that was just semicolon after semicolon, right? When this happens, when you experience it this way, when you experience it this way, then you'll get it, right? Part of what is so gutting for me about that is that I have a really hard time imagining that experience of the world. Part of the way that that I'm finding myself really running up against the racism that I have inherited is that as a white person, I have so little imagination. I have so little imagination for what Dr. King's experience was and what the experience of people of color in my own community is. I have so little imagination for what African Americans experience the rules that they know they have to follow that I don't have to follow. I don't even have to know they're there. And that means that my ability to perceive the world is stunted, right? It's like a color that I can't see, right? If I was red, green, colorblind, I would be unable to sort out things that were differentiated by those two colors. It's like a sense I don't have, which also means I can't properly imagine a world where these things don't happen. Right? I can't properly imagine how we would get to a world where these things don't happen. And that troubles me as a well-meaning white moderate, right? that troubles me as someone who would like to help make things better, but I can't imagine a world that's actually better in the kinds of ways it would need to be. And I struggle to bring myself to listen to those who know what it would take to get from here to there. So what responsibility do people of faith have to actively work to correct the sin of racism? What responsibility do people of faith and communities of faith have to actively work to correct the sin of racism?
Well, they have to acknowledge that it still exists.
We have to acknowledge that it still exists.
I mean, you know, like you said, you can't imagine it's all white. You
know? Yeah. We have to believe people of color when they tell us what racism is. We have to believe people of color when they tell us what racism is. Because it's often something that we can't see.
And to speak out instead of being like, you know, turning a blind eye to it.
Yeah. That was another piece in what you were saying, Warren, that that really connected with me. You touched on the difficulty of behaving differently around family and friends who expected you to behave in a certain way.
Well, I made that assumption. See, now I may have sold some of my friends and family short, and they might have not have shunned Warren, they might have patted him on the back.
Right.
See, but, you know, in that uncertain area, I opted to be the conservative. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to be the... Well, that's just my personality. But
It's not only your personality, though. It is also your personality, sure. You know, you get along well with things, right?
I went close.
You read what they, you know, you read kind of what people are expecting to have happen and so forth. But it's also part of whiteness.
Sure.
Part of whiteness is to to actively avoid rocking the boat. And particularly to actively avoid speaking out when our white friends are being racist. Because, I mean, it's just us, right? Like, there's no one here in the room with us to be offended by something we might say. And so, you know, I don't need to go there. I don't need to rock that boat. But everything we say here in this room is practice for how we're going to act in any other situation. And it is our work. But there's a tendency that, again, some really helpful people of color have pointed out. There is the tendency to just wait for the person of color in the room to speak up for themselves, which puts all the work on them to fight against their own oppression. And what's Dr. King asking us to do?
Reach out.
To reach out, to stand up next to him for the justice that he's working for. And that's exactly what the clergy letter was trying to avoid. Right? The clergy letter was saying, y'all need to tone it down, because if I have to stand up next to you, I'm breaking this code of white silence. So it is also psychological for many, lots of us, right? It's part of group psychology that social psychology teaches us to get along with whatever our group happens to be, even at cost to ourselves, right? That's why when we do this fancy newfangled Lord's Prayer that's only 40 years old, if I'm saying the new version, you're a lot more likely to say the new version along with me. If I'm saying the King James Version of the Lord's Prayer, I can say the King James Version just like I learned, right?
I thought about that yesterday, but I wondered what...
Oh, and they did trespasses because they're Methodists. But did you hear Adam when we were talking to him in the narthex?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he said, you guys are more right on that than we are. Thank you, sir. I know how to read Greek, too. He's right.
But the assistant pastor, when she led the Lord's Prayer,
uh-huh.
I wondered whether the newer or the old version.
Right.
And she used the old, the traditional.
Yes, yeah. So they were our Father who art in heaven. That's mm-hmm. So that's your instant clue, right?
Yeah.
If there's an art in the first line, then you know you're going to be these and thys all the way through. But you have to know what denomination you're in, whether you're going to do debts or trespasses even then, right?
And in the lobby, I said, the debtors have to wait for the trespassers. And
that's right.
Which I've heard many times.
And, that's right.
he chuckled at that.
Yeah. So, but that's social psychology, right? Here we are. We're in this room with all these Methodists. This is the folks who went on the bus trip to the Church of the Resurrection yesterday. Here we are in this room with all these Methodists. We better say trespasses. Right? We better do it the way they expect us to do it. That's how the psychological layer of white silence works. It is our saying, everyone expects that we're just going to let this off-color joke go by, right?
And I think that's what he means. It says in here that groups are more immoral than individuals.
Mm-hmm.
We can be who we are in our own mind, but when we're with the group, we just kind of have
a... Right, yeah. So we experience this internal tension. And there, you know, there's a limit to what Niebuhr said there. But we experience this internal tension where we know what's right and what's wrong, but we also know what everyone else expects of us. There's a problem, there's a bug in the system of that social psychology, because we can all think that what the group is doing and what the group is expecting is this, and we can all think the group is wrong and still go there, right? And so it takes standing up, right? It takes rocking the boat. It takes saying, I'm not comfortable with where that just went. And that's hard to do. That is really hard to do. And it is, again, this is, I need to cite some really brave, helpful people of color who have helped me recognize that, not that I act on it at all well, right? But that have helped me recognize that, that this norm of white silence allows all of that stuff that we all, you know, we can read what Dr. King writes about the experience of being a Negro in 1963, and we can read what contemporary authors are saying to us about, here's the experience of being an African American in the United States in 2019. We can read that and say, oh, that's awful. And then the next time we hear something that reinforces all of that, we say, not my place. And Dr. King says, goodness, it's our place. Marilyn.
I can remember when Bob was transferred from to Des Moines, I was so kind of naive in thinking it would be okay if Bob met our sister-in-law and they selected our home, never thinking about where you select a home. And it was after we were in what was then very lily white
mm-hmm.
West Des Moines, I thought, you know, when I got to know the community, it would have been really smart of us to move to a area where the kids would go to Roosevelt
mm-hmm.
and be exposed to other kids like I was when I grew up.
Right.
You know, and I was just so blind to the whole, I did not stand up and make a conscious decision.
Yeah.
And I always, you know, it was like I was asleep
mm-hmm.
to that reality.
Right.
And it would be great if we were prepared to look at situations where we should stand up, mm-hmm. and where we would be more likely to do that if we were thinking.
Yeah. So let me name one other piece of this is actually a shift over the past couple of generations. And a shift in the way that well-meaning white folks ought to try to think. So you all, I'm just gonna age you all here. You all either grew up with or grew into the idea that what we need to do is not see color, right? Have you heard that from well-meaning white folks? You know, sort of colorblind policies that don't reinforce Jim Crow by discriminating, redlining or whatever the situation may be that we're pushing against. We're going to have colorblind policies that apply to everyone equally. We're going to have sort of colorblind psychology that we're not going to see color in those around us. Oh, that, you know, I don't see, when I look at my kids, the colorblind idea is that I should not see two Korean boys, right? I should see just kids, right? The problem with that is actually exactly what you described, Marilyn, that we can find ourselves moving into wonderful little lily white worlds where we don't know that there's another experience out there, that we don't know what the actual person in front of us does experience on a day-to-day basis. So if we, the experience of a community reacting to a police shooting of an unarmed young black man, where we go with that is down a very white train of logic that, well, there must have been something that happened there that provoked the police officer that made this situation different from every other situation. And we miss what's actually going on there. The same thing happens in our actual day-to-day interactions with people of color in our own lives. That we miss the ways that we ourselves are reinforcing the same racism that they experience all through the rest of their lives. If we don't look at them and say, I recognize who you are, and you're not defined by your race, right? But I know that your experience of the world is so shaped by the way that your race shapes the world around you. And so there's a big shift that is conceptually really hard for lots of us, including me. I think I'm making progress here, but I'm not there yet. But a shift from what we need to do is just not see color to what we need to do is see color and know where it is so that we can continue working toward the goal of valuing everyone's experiences in their individuality and uniqueness. But my experience in its individuality and uniqueness is shaped by being a white kid from the upper Midwest. The experience of an African American living in the same part of Des Moines that I live in, their experience is shaped by being African American in the same part of Des Moines I live in. And we have very different experiences, and if I can't recognize the way that race shapes that experience, I can't truly imagine what their world is. So that's a lot harder than just imagining I could be colorblind. But as you said, Marilyn, it's a difference in the size of the experience we're capable of having.
When we worked on a mission in the inner city rehabbing houses, it's called the Annawim Project, which still exists. we always marveled that the white woman who headed, she was a nun, lived right there in the heart of the black community. And I have to say that I always wondered how safe that was. Mm. And why she made that decision. Uh-huh. I think she lived with others from her order so that she wasn't the only white person.
Uh-huh.
But I often wondered, I see now why you say what you do, and that she was trying to understand what it was like to be black and to be living in that kind of housing, mm-hmm. and what it meant to them to have that housing rehabbed.
Right. Yeah. And there is no conceivable way that she successfully ministered in that neighborhood without understanding better than I do the experience of blackness in that neighborhood. There is no conceivable way that she did that in a colorblind approach, right?
Right.
Okay, we're going to turn next week to extremism, because that's part of the accusation against Dr. King. So we're going to talk about what is extremism and what kind of extremists are we going to choose to be. So I will see you next week.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.